us as witches, and the Kirch sell us as slaves. The Shuhan carve us up, seeking the source of our power. What else?
They said you were the strongest Darkling in generations.
I didn't ask you for flattery.
I fingered a loose thread on the cuff of my kefta. He watched me, waiting. Well, I said, there was an old serf who worked on the estate.
Go on,
he said.
Tell me.
He said that Darklings are born without souls, that only something truly evil could have created the Shadowfold. I glanced at his cold face and added hastily, but Anacuya sent him packing and told us it was all peasant superstition. The Darkling sighed.
I doubt that serf is the only one who believes that.
I said nothing. Not everyone thought like Eva or the old serf, but I'd been in the First Army long enough to know that most ordinary soldiers didn't trust Grisha and felt no allegiance to the Darkling. After a moment, the Darkling said,
"My great-great-great-grandfather was the Black Heretic, the Darkling who created the Shadowfold. It was a mistake, an experiment born of greed, maybe his evil. I don't know. But every Darkling since then has tried to undo the damage he did to our country. And I'm no different."
He turned to me then, his expression serious, the firelight playing over the perfect planes of his features.
"I've spent my life searching for a way to make things right. You're the first glimmer of hope I've had in a long time."
"Me?"
"The world is changing, Alina. Muskets and rifles are just the beginning. I've seen the weapons they're developing in Kirch and Fierja. The age of Grisha power is coming to an end."
It was a terrifying thought. But what about the First Army? They have rifles. They have weapons.
Where do you think their rifles come from? Their ammunition. Every time we cross the fold, we lose lives. A divided Ravka won't survive the new age. We need our ports. We need our harbors. And only you can give them back to us.
How?
I pleaded.
How am I supposed to do that?
By helping me destroy the Shadowfold.
I shook my head. You're crazy. This is all crazy. I looked up through the broken beams of the barn's roof to the night sky. It was full of stars, but I could only see the endless reaches of darkness between them. I imagined myself standing in the dead silence of the Shadowfold, blind, frightened, with nothing to protect me but my supposed power. I thought of the Black Heretic. He had created the Fold, a Darkling just like the one who sat watching me so closely in the firelight. "What about that thing you did?" I asked before I could lose my nerve. "To the Fjerdan." He looked back into the fire.
"It's called the Cut. It requires great power and great focus. It's something few Grisha can do."
I rubbed my arms, trying to stave off the chill that had taken hold of me. He glanced at me and then back to the fire.
"If I had cut him down with a sword, would that make it any better?"
"Would it?" I had seen countless horrors in the last few days, but even after the nightmares of the Fold, the image that stayed with me, that reared up in my dreams and chased me into waking, was of the bearded man's severed body, swaying in the dappled sunlight before it toppled onto me.
"I don't know," I said quietly.
Something flashed across his face, something that looked like anger or maybe even pain. Without another word, he rose and walked away from me. I watched him disappear into the darkness and felt suddenly guilty. "Don't be a fool," I chastised myself. "He's the Darkling. He's the second most powerful man in Ravka. He's 120 years old. You didn't hurt his feelings." But I thought of the look that had flickered over his features, the shame in his voice when he talked about the Black Heretic. And I couldn't shake the feeling that I had failed some kind of test. 2 days later, just after dawn, we passed through a massive gate and the famous double walls of Os Alta. Mal and I had taken our training, not far from here, in the military stronghold at Politsnaya, but we had never been inside the city itself. Os Alta was reserved for the very wealthy, for the homes of military and government officials, their families, their mistresses, and all the business that catered to them. I felt a twinge of disappointment as we passed shuttered shops, a wide marketplace where a few vendors were already setting up their stalls, and crowded rows of narrow houses. Os Alta was called the Dream City. It was the capital of Ravka, home to the Grisha and the King's Grand Palace. But if anything, it just looked like a bigger, dirtier version of the market town at Keremzin. All that changed when we reached the bridge. It spanned a wide canal where little boats bobbed in the water beneath it. And on the other side, rising from the mist, white and gleaming, lay the other Os Alta. As we crossed the bridge, we saw that it could be raised to turn the canal into a giant moat that would separate the Dream City before us from the common mess of the market town that lay behind. When we reached the other side of the canal, it was as if we had passed into another world. Everywhere I looked, I saw fountains and plazas, verdant parks, and broad boulevards lined with perfect rows of trees. Here and there I saw lights on, in the lower stories of the grand houses, where kitchen fires were being lit and the day's work was starting. The streets began to slope upward, and as we climbed higher, the houses became larger and more imposing until finally we arrived at another wall and another set of gates, these wrought in gleaming gold and emblazoned with the king's double eagle. Along the wall I could see heavily armed men at their posts, a grim reminder that for all its beauty, Os Alta was still the capital of a country that had long been at war. The gate swung open. We rode up a broad path paved in glittering gravel and bordered by rows of elegant trees. To the left and right, stretching into the distance, I saw manicured gardens, rich with green and hazy in the mist of early morning. Above it all, atop a series of marble terraces and golden fountains, loomed the Grand Palace, the Ravkin King's winter home. When we finally reached the huge double eagle fountain at its base, the Darkling brought his horse up beside mine.
"So, what do you think of it?"
I glanced at him, then back at the elaborate facade. It was larger than any building I had ever seen, its terraces crowded with statues, its 3 stories gleaming with row after row of shining windows, each ornamented extensively in what I suspected was real gold. "It's very grand," I said carefully. He looked at me, a little smile playing on his lips.
"I think it's the ugliest building I've ever seen," he said, and nudged his horse forward.
We followed a path that curved behind the palace and deeper into the grounds, passing a hedge maze, a rolling lawn with a columned temple at its center, and a vast greenhouse, its windows clouded with condensation. Then we entered a thick stand of trees, large enough that it felt like a small wood, and passed through a long, dark corridor, where the branches made a dense, braided roof above us. The hair rose on my arms. I had the same feeling that I'd had as we were crossing the canal, that sense of crossing the boundary between 2 worlds. When we emerged from the tunnel into weak sunshine, I looked down a gentle slope and saw a building like nothing I'd ever seen.
"Welcome to the Little Palace," said the Darkling.
It was a strange name because, though it was smaller than the Grand Palace, the Little Palace was still huge. It rose from the trees surrounding it like something carved from an enchanted forest, a cluster of dark wood walls and golden domes. As we drew closer, I saw that every inch of it was covered in intricate carvings of birds and flowers, twisting vines and magical beasts. A charcoal-clad group of servants waited on the steps. I dismounted, and one of them rushed forward to take my horse, while others pushed open a large set of double doors. As we passed through them, I couldn't resist the urge to reach out and touch the exquisite carvings. They had been inlaid with mother-of-pearl, so that they sparkled in the early morning light. How many hands? How many years had it taken to create such a place? We passed through an entry chamber, and then into a vast hexagonal room with four long tables arranged in a square at its center. Our footsteps echoed off the stone floor, and a massive gold dome seemed to float above us at an impossible height. The Darkling took aside one of the servants, an older woman in a charcoal dress, and spoke to her in hushed tones. Then he gave me a small bow and strode off across the hall, followed by his men. I felt a surge of annoyance. The Darkling had said little to me since that night in the barn, and he'd given me no idea what I might expect once we arrived. But I didn't have the nerve or the energy to run after him, so I meekly followed the woman in gray through another pair of double doors and into one of the smaller towers. When I saw all the stairs, I almost broke down and wept. "Maybe I'll just ask if I can stay down here in the middle of the hall," I thought miserably. Instead, I put my hand on the carved banister and dragged myself upward, my stiff body protesting every step. When we reached the top, I felt like celebrating by lying down and taking a nap, but the servant was already moving down the hallway. We passed door after door until finally we reached a chamber where another uniformed maid stood waiting by an open doorway. Dimly I registered a large room, heavy golden curtains, a fire burning in a beautifully tiled grate. But all I really cared about was the huge canopied bed. "Can I get you anything? Something to eat?" asked the woman. I shook my head. I just wanted to sleep. "Very good," she said, and nodded to the maid, who curtsied and disappeared down the hall. "Then I'll let you rest. Make sure to lock your door." I blinked. "As a precaution," said the woman, and left, closing the door gently behind her. A precaution against what? I wondered. But I was too tired to think about it. I locked the door, peeled off the kefta and my boots, and fell into bed. Chapter 6. I dreamed that I was back in Kerimson, slipping through the darkened hallways on stockinged feet, trying to find Mal. I could hear him calling to me, but his voice never seemed to get any closer. Finally, I reached the top floor and the door to the old blue bedroom where we like to sit in the window seat and look out at our meadow. I heard Mal laughing. I threw open the door and screamed. There was blood everywhere. The Volcra was perched on the window seat, and as it turned on me and opened its horrible jaws, I saw that it had gray quartz eyes. I bolted awake, my heart thudding in my chest, and looked around in terror. For a moment, I couldn't remember where I was. Then I groaned and flopped back onto the pillows. I had just started to doze off again when someone began pounding on the door. "Go away," I mumbled from beneath the covers, but the pounding only grew louder. I sat up, feeling my whole body shriek in rebellion. My head ached, and when I tried to stand, my legs did not want to cooperate. "All right," I shouted. "I'm coming." The knocking stopped. I stumbled over to the door and reached for the lock, but then I hesitated. "Who is it?" "I don't have time for this," a female voice snapped from behind the door. "Open, now." I shrugged. Let them kill me or kidnap me or whatever they wanted. As long as I didn't have to ride a horse or climb stairs, I wouldn't complain. I had barely unlocked the door when it flew open and a tall girl pushed past me, surveying the room and then me with a critical eye. She was easily the most beautiful person I'd ever seen. Her wavy hair was deepest auburn, her irises large and golden. Her skin was so smooth and flawless that she looked as if her perfect cheekbones had been carved from marble. She wore a cream-colored kefta, embroidered in gold and lined in reddish fox fur. "All saints," she said, looking me over. "Have you even bathed? And what happened to your face?" I flushed bright red, my hands flying to the bruise on my cheek. It had been nearly a week since I'd left camp, and longer since I'd bathed or brushed my hair. I was covered in dirt and blood and the smell of horses. But the girl was already shouting orders to the servants who had followed her into the room. "Draw a bath, a hot one. I'll need my kit and get her out of those clothes." The servants descended upon me, pulling at my buttons. "Hey!" I shouted, batting their hands away. The Grisha rolled her eyes. "Hold her down if you have to." The servants redoubled their efforts. "Stop!" I shouted, backing away from them. They hesitated, looking from me to the girl. Honestly, nothing sounded better than a hot bath and a change of clothes, but I wasn't about to let some tyrannical redhead push me around. "What is going on? Who are you?"
"I don't have to
make time," I snapped. "I've covered almost 200 miles on horseback. I haven't had a good night's sleep in a week, and I've nearly been killed twice. So before I do anything else, you're going to have to tell me who you are and why it's so very important that you get my clothes off."
The redhead took a deep breath and said slowly, as if she were speaking to a child,
"My name is Jenya. In less than an hour, you will be presented to the king, and it is my job to make you look presentable."
My anger evaporated. I was going to meet the king.
"Oh,"
I said meekly.
"Yes, oh. So shall we?"
I nodded mutely, and Jenya clapped her hands. The servants flew into action, yanking at my clothes and dragging me into the bathroom. Last night I'd been too tired to notice the room, but now, even shivering and scared witless at the prospect of having to meet the king, I marveled at the tiny bronze tiles that rippled over every surface and the sunken oval tub of beaten copper that the servants were filling with steaming water. Beside the tub, the wall was covered in a mosaic of shells and shimmering abalone.
In,
said one of the servants, giving me a nudge. I climbed in. The water was painfully hot, but I endured it rather than try to ease in slowly. Military life had long ago cured me of most of my modesty, but there was something very different about being the only naked person in the room, especially when everyone kept shooting curious glances at me. I squeaked as one of the servants grabbed my head and began furiously washing my hair. Another leaned over the tub and started scrubbing my nails. Once I adjusted to it, the heat of the water felt good on my aching body. I hadn't had a bath in well over a year, and I had never even dreamed that there might be such a tub. Clearly, being Grisha had its benefits. I could have spent an hour just paddling around. But once I had been thoroughly dunked and scrubbed, a servant yanked my arm and ordered, "Out! Out!" Reluctantly, I climbed from the tub, letting the woman dry me roughly with thick towels. One of the younger servants stepped forward with a heavy velvet robe and led me into the bedroom. Then she and the others backed out the door, leaving me alone with Jenya. I watched the redhead warily. She had thrown open the curtains and pulled an elaborately carved wooden table and chair over by the windows.
"Sit,"
she commanded. I bridled at her tone, but I obeyed. A small trunk lay open by her hand, its contents spread out on the tabletop, squat glass jars full of what looked like berries, leaves, and colored powders. I didn't have a chance to investigate further because Jenya took hold of my chin, peering closely at my face and turning my bruised cheek toward the light from the window. She took a breath and let her fingers travel over my skin. I felt the same prickling sensation I'd experienced when the healer took care of my wounds from the fold. Long minutes passed as I clenched my hands into fists to keep from scratching. Then Jenya stepped back, and the itching receded. She handed me a small golden hand mirror. The bruise was completely gone. I pressed the skin tentatively, but there was no soreness.
"Thank you,"
I said, setting the mirror down and starting to stand. But Jenya pushed me right back down into the chair.
"Where do you think you're going? We're not done."
"But
if the Darkling wanted you healed, he would have sent a healer."
"You're not a healer? I'm not wearing red, am I? Jenny retorted, an edge of bitterness to her voice. She gestured herself.
I'm a tailor.
I was baffled. I realized I'd never seen a Grisha in white kefta.
You're going to make me a dress?
Jenya blew out an exasperated breath.
Not the robes. This,
she said, waving her long, graceful fingers before her face.
You don't think I was born looking like this, do you?
I stared at the smooth marble perfection of Jenya's features as realization set in, and with it, a wave of indignation.
You want to change my face?
Not change it, just freshen you up a bit. I scowled. I knew what I looked like. In fact, I was acutely aware of my shortcomings. But I really didn't need a gorgeous Grisha pointing them out to me. And worse was the fact that the Darkling had sent her to do it.
Forget it, I said, jumping to my feet.
If the Darkling doesn't like the way I look, that's his problem.
Do you like the way you look?
Jenya asked with what seemed to be genuine curiosity.
Not particularly, I snapped. But my life has gotten confusing enough without seeing a stranger's face in the mirror.
It doesn't work that way, Jenya said. I can't make big changes, just small ones. Even out your skin. Do something with that mousy hair of yours. I've perfected myself, but I've had my whole life to do it.
I wanted to argue, but she actually was perfect.
Get out. Jenya cocked her head to one side, studying me.
Why are you taking this so personally?
Wouldn't you?
I have no idea. I've always been beautiful.
And humble, too? She shrugged.
So I'm beautiful. That doesn't mean much among Grisha. The Darkling doesn't care what you look like, just what you do.
Then why did he send you?
Because the king loves beauty, and the Darkling knows that. In the king's court, appearances are everything. If you're to be the salvation of all of Ravka, well, it would be better if you looked the part.
I crossed my arms and looked out the window. Outside, the sun was shining off a small lake, a tiny island at its center. I had no idea what time it was or how long it slept. Jenya walked over to me.
You're not ugly, you know.
Thanks, I said dryly, still staring out at the wooded grounds.
You just look a little...
tired? Sickly? Skinny?
Well,
Jenya said reasonably.
You said it yourself. You've been traveling hard for days and...
I sighed. This is how I always look. I rested my head on the cool glass, feeling the anger and embarrassment drain out of me. What was I fighting for? If I was honest with myself, the prospect of what Jenya was offering was tempting.
Fine, I said.
Do it.
Thank you,
exclaimed Jenya, clapping her hands together. I looked at her sharply, but there was no sarcasm in her voice or expression.
She's relieved, I realized.
The Darkling had set Jenya a task, and I wondered what might have happened to her if I'd refused. I let her lead me back to the chair.
Just don't get carried away, I said.
Don't worry, said the redhead. You'll still look like yourself, just like you've had more than a few hours of sleep.
I'm very good.
I can see that, I said.
I closed my eyes.
It's okay, she said. You can watch. She handed me the gold mirror.
But no more talk, and stay still.
I held up the mirror and watched as Jenya's cool fingertips descended slowly over my forehead. My skin prickled, and I watched with growing amazement as Jenya's hands traveled over my skin. Every blemish, every scrape, every flaw seemed to disappear beneath her fingers. She placed her thumbs beneath my eyes.
Oh,
I exclaimed in surprise, as the dark circles that had plagued me since childhood disappeared.
Don't get too excited, Jenya said. It's temporary.
She reached for one of the roses on the table and plucked a pale pink petal. She held it up to my cheek, and the color bled from the petal onto my skin, leaving what looked like a pretty flush. Then she held a fresh petal to my lips and repeated the process.
It only lasts a few days, she informed me. Now the hair.
She plucked a long comb made of bone from her trunk, along with a glass jar full of something shiny. Stunned, I asked, Is that real gold?
Of course,
Jenya said, lifting a chunk of my dull brown hair. She shook some of the gold leaf onto the crown of my head, and as she pulled the comb through my hair, the gold seemed to dissolve into shimmering strands. As Jenya finished with each section, she wound it around her fingers, letting the hair fall in waves. Finally, she stepped back, wearing a smug smile.
Better, no?
I examined myself in the mirror. My hair shone. My cheeks held a rosy flush. I still wasn't pretty, but I couldn't deny the improvement. I wondered what Mal would think if he saw me, then shoved the thought away. Better, I agreed grudgingly. Jenya gave a plaintive sigh.
It's really the best I can do for now.
Thanks, I said tartly. But then Jenya winked at me and smiled.
Besides, she said, you don't want to attract too much attention from the king.
Her voice was light, but I saw a shadow pass over her features as she strode across the room and opened the door to let the servants rush back in. They pushed me behind an ebony screen inlaid with mother-of-pearl stars so that it resembled a night sky. In a few moments I was dressed in a clean tunic and trousers, soft leather boots, and a gray coat. With disappointment I realized it was just a clean version of my army uniform. There was even a little cartographer's patch showing a compass rose on the right sleeve. My feelings must have shown on my face.
Not what you expected?
Jenya asked with some amusement.
I just thought.
But what had I thought? Did I really think I belonged in Grisha robes?
The king expects to see a humble girl plucked from the ranks of his army, an undiscovered treasure. If you appear in a kefta, he'll think the Darkling's been hiding you.
Why would the Darkling hide me? Jenya shrugged.
For leverage, for profit, who knows? But the king is...
Well, you'll see what the king is. My stomach turned. I was about to be presented to the king. I tried to steady myself, but as Jenya hurried me out the door and down the hall, my legs felt leaden and shaky. Near the bottom of the stairs, she whispered,
If anyone asks, I just helped you get dressed. I'm not supposed to work on Grisha.
Why not?
Because the ridiculous queen and her more ridiculous court think it's not fair.
I gaped at her. Insulting the queen could be considered treason, but Jenya seemed unconcerned. When we entered the huge domed hall, it was crowded with Grisha in robes of crimson, purple, and darkest blue. Most of them looked to be around my age, but a few older Grisha were gathered in a corner. Despite the silver in their hair and their lined faces, they were strikingly attractive. In fact, everyone in the room was unnervingly good-looking.
The queen may have a point, I murmured. Oh, this isn't my handiwork, said Jenya.
I frowned. If Jenya was telling the truth, then this was just further evidence that I didn't belong here. Someone had seen us enter the hall, and a hush fell as every eye in the room fastened onto me. A tall, broad-chested Grisha in red robes came forward. He had deeply tanned skin and seemed to exude good health. He made a low bow and said,
I am Sergei Biznikov. I know who you are, of course,
Sergei interrupted, his white teeth flashing.
Come, let me introduce you. You'll be walking with us.
He took me by the elbow and began to steer me toward a group of corporalki.
She's a summoner, Sergei,
said a girl in a blue kefta with flowing brown curls.
She walks with us.
There were murmurs of assent from the other etherealki behind her.
Marie, said Sergei with an insincere smile, you can't possibly be suggesting that she enter the hall as a lower-order Grisha.
Marie's alabaster skin went suddenly blotchy, and several of the summoners got to their feet. Need I remind you that the Darkling himself is a summoner?
So, you're ranking yourself with the Darkling now?
Marie sputtered, and in an attempt to make peace, I interjected. Why don't I just go with Jenya? There were a few low snickers.
With the tailor?
Sergei asked, looking aghast. I glanced at Jenya, who simply smiled and shook her head.
She belongs with us, protested Marie,
and an argument broke out all around us.
She'll walk with me, said a low voice, and the room went silent.
Chapter 7 I turned and saw the Darkling standing in an archway, flanked by Ivan and several other Grisha whom I recognized from the journey. Marie and Sergei backed away hastily. The Darkling surveyed the crowd and said,
"We are expected."
Instantly the room bustled with activity as the Grisha rose and began to file through the large double doors that led outside. They arranged themselves two abreast in a long line. First, the Materialkai, then the Etherealkai, and finally the Corporalkai, so that the highest-ranked Grisha would enter the throne room last. Unsure of what to do, I stayed where I was, watching the crowd. I looked around for Jenya, but she seemed to have disappeared. A moment later, the Darkling was beside me. I glanced up at his pale profile, the sharp jaw, the granite eyes.
"You look well rested," he said.
I bristled. I wasn't comfortable with what Jenya had done, but standing in a room full of beautiful Grisha, I had to admit that I was grateful for it. I still didn't look like I belonged, but I would have stuck out much worse without Jenya's help. "Are there other tailors?" I asked.
"Jenya is unique," he answered, glancing at me. "Like us."
I ignored the little thrill that went through me at the word "us" and said, "Why isn't she walking with the rest of the Grisha?"
"Jenya must attend to the queen."
"Why?"
"When Jenya's abilities began to show themselves, I could have had her choose between becoming a fabricator or a corporal, Nick. Instead, I cultivated her particular affinity and made a gift of her to the queen."
"A gift? So a Grisha is no better than a serf?"
"We all serve someone," he said,
and I was surprised by the harsh edge in his voice. Then he added,
"The king will expect a demonstration."
I felt as if I'd been dunked in ice water. "But I don't know how to..."
"I don't expect you to,"
he said calmly, moving forward as the last of the red-robed Corporalkai disappeared through the door. We emerged onto the gravel path and into the last of the afternoon sunshine. I was finding it hard to breathe. I felt as if I were walking to my execution. "Maybe I am," I thought with a surge of dread.
"This isn't fair," I whispered angrily. "I don't know what the king thinks I can do, but it isn't fair to throw me out there and expect me to just make things happen."
"I hope you don't expect fairness from me, Alina. It isn't one of my specialties."
I stared at him. What was I supposed to make out of that? The Darkling glanced down at me.
"Do you really believe I brought you all this way to make a fool out of you? Out of both of us?"
"No,"
I admitted. "And it's completely out of your hands now, isn't it?"
he said as we made our way through the dark, wooded tunnel of branches. That was true, too, if not particularly comforting. I had no choice but to trust that he knew what he was doing. I had a sudden unpleasant thought. "Are you going to cut me again?" I asked.
"I doubt I'll have to, but it all depends on you."
I was not reassured. I tried to calm myself and to slow the beating of my heart, but before I knew it, we had made our way through the grounds and were climbing the white marble steps to the Grand Palace. As we moved through a spacious entry hall into a long corridor lined with mirrors and ornamented in gold, I thought how different this place was from the little palace. Everywhere I looked, I saw marble and gold, soaring walls of white and palest blue, gleaming chandeliers, liveried footmen,
polished parquet floors laid out in elaborate geometric designs. It wasn't without beauty, but there was something exhausting about the extravagance of it all. I'd always assumed that Ravka's hungry peasants and poorly supplied soldiers were the result of the Shadow Fold. But as we walked by a tree of jade, embellished with diamond leaves, I wasn't so sure. The throne room was 3 stories high, every window sparkling with gold double eagles. A long pale blue carpet ran the length of the room where the members of the court milled about a raised throne. Many of the men wore military dress, black trousers and white coats laden with metal and ribbons. The women sparkled in gowns of liquid silk, with little puffed sleeves and low necklines. Flanking the carpeted aisle, the Grisha stood arranged in their separate orders. A hush fell as every face turned to me and the Darkling. We walked slowly toward the golden throne. As we drew closer, the king sat up straighter, tense with excitement. He looked to be in his 40s, slender and round-shouldered, with big watery eyes and a pale mustache. He wore full military dress, a thin sword at his side, his narrow chest covered with medals. Beside him on the raised dais stood a man with a long dark beard. He wore priest's robes, but a gold double eagle was emblazoned on his chest. The Darkling gave my arm a gentle squeeze to warn me that we were stopping.
"Your Highness, Moetzar," he said in clear tones. "Alina Starkov, the Sun Summoner."
A rush of murmurs came from the crowd. I wasn't sure if I should bow or curtsy. Anakuya had insisted that all the orphans know how to greet the Duke's few noble guests, but somehow it didn't feel right to curtsy in army-issue trousers. The king saved me from making a blunder when he waved us forward impatiently.
"Come, come, bring her to me."
The Darkling and I walked to the base of the dais. The king scrutinized me. He frowned and his lower lip jutted out slightly.
"She's very plain."
I flushed a bit and bit my tongue. The king wasn't much to look at either. He was practically chinless, and close up I could see the broken blood vessels in his nose.
"Show me,"
the king commanded. My stomach clenched. I looked at the Darkling. This was it. He nodded at me and spread his arms wide. A tense silence descended as his hand filled with dark, swirling ribbons of blackness that bled into the air. He brought his hands together with a resounding crack. Nervous cries burst from the crowd as darkness blanketed the room. This time I was better prepared for the dark that engulfed me, but it was still frightening. Instinctively, I reached forward, searching for something to hold on to. The Darkling caught my arm, and his bare hand slid into mine. I felt that same powerful certainty wash through me, and then the Darkling's call. Pure and compelling, demanding an answer. With a mixture of panic and relief, I felt something rising up inside me. This time I didn't try to fight it. I let it have its way. Light flooded the throne room, drenching us in warmth and shattering the darkness like black glass. The court erupted into applause. People were weeping and hugging one another. A woman fainted. The king was clapping the loudest, rising from his throne and applauding furiously, his expression exultant. The Darkling let go of my hand and the light faded.
"Brilliant!" the king shouted. "A miracle!"
He descended the steps of the dais, the bearded priest gliding silently behind him, and took my hand in his own, raising it to his wet lips.
"My dear girl," he said. "My dear, dear girl."
I thought of what Jenya had said about the king's attention and felt my skin crawl, but I didn't dare pull my hand away. Soon, though, he had relinquished me and was clapping the Darkling on the back.
"Miraculous! Simply miraculous!"
he effused.
"Come, we must make plans immediately."
As the king and the Darkling stepped away to talk, the priest drifted forward.
"A miracle indeed," he said, staring at me with a disturbing intensity.
His eyes were so brown they were almost black, and he smelled faintly of mildew and incense. Like a tomb, I thought with a shiver. I was grateful when he slithered away to join the king. I was quickly surrounded by beautifully dressed men and women, all wishing to make my acquaintance and to touch my hand or my sleeve. They crowded on every side of me, jostling and pushing to get closer. Just as I felt fresh panic settle in, Jenya appeared by my side. But my relief was short-lived.
"The queen wants to meet you," she murmured into my ear.
She steered me through the crowd and out a narrow side door into the hall, then into a jewel-like sitting room where the queen reclined on a divan, a snuffling dog with a pushed-in face cradled on her lap. The queen was beautiful, with glossy blonde hair in a perfect coiffure, her delicate features cold and lovely. But there was also something a little odd about her face. Her irises seemed a little too blue, her hair too yellow, her skin too smooth. I wondered just how much work Jenya had done on her. She was surrounded by ladies in exquisite gowns of petal pink and soft blue, their low necklines embroidered with gilded thread and tiny river pearls, and yet they all paled beside Jenya in her simple cream wool kefta, her bright red hair burning like a flame. "Moya tsaritsa," Jenya said, sinking into a low, graceful curtsy. "The Sun Summoner." This time I had to make a choice. I executed a small bow and heard a few low titters from the ladies.
"Charming," said the queen. "I loathe pretense."
It took all my willpower not to snort at this.
"You are from a Grisha family?" she asked.
I glanced nervously at Jenya, who nodded encouragement.
"No," I said,
and then quickly added,
"Moya tsaritsa."
"A peasant, then?"
I nodded.
"We are so lucky in our people," the queen said,
and the ladies murmured soft assent.
"Your family must be notified of your new status. Jenya will send a messenger."
Jenya nodded and gave another little curtsy. I thought about just nodding right along with her, but I wasn't sure I wanted to start lying to royalty. "Actually, Your Highness, I was raised in Duke Karamazov's household." The ladies buzzed in surprise, and even Jenya looked curious.
"An orphan?"
exclaimed the queen, sounding delighted.
"How marvelous!"
I wasn't sure that I would describe my parents being dead as marvelous, but at a loss for anything to say, I mumbled, "Thank you, Moya Tsaritsa."
"This all must seem so very strange to you."
"Take care that life at court does not corrupt you the way it has others," she said, her blue marble eyes sliding to Jenya. The insult was unmistakable, but Jenya's expression betrayed nothing, a fact which did not seem to please the queen. She dismissed us with a flick of her ring-laden fingers.
"Go now."
As Jenya led me back into the hallway, I thought I heard her mutter, "Old cow." But before I could decide whether or not to ask her about what the queen had said, the darkling was there, steering us down an empty corridor.
"How did you fare with the queen?" he asked.
"I have no idea," I said honestly. Everything she said was perfectly nice, but the whole time she was looking at me as if I were something her dog spit up. Jenya laughed, and the darkling's lips quirked in what was nearly a smile.
"Welcome to court," he said.
"I'm not sure I like it."
"No one does," he admitted. "But we all make a good show of it."
"The king seemed pleased," I offered.
"The king is a child."
My mouth fell open in shock, and I looked around nervously, afraid someone had overheard. These people seemed to speak treason as easily as breathing. Jenya didn't look remotely disturbed by the darkling's words. The darkling must have noticed my discomfort, because he said,
"But today, you've made him a very happy child."
"Who was that bearded man with the king?" I asked, eager to change the subject.
"The apparat?"
"Is he a priest?"
"Of a sort. Some say he's a fanatic. Others say he's a fraud."
"And you?"
"I say he has his uses."
The darkling turned to Jenya.
I think we've asked enough of Alina for today,
he said.
Take her back to her chambers and have her fitted for her kefta. She will start instruction tomorrow.
Jenya gave a little bow and laid her hand on my arm to lead me away. I was overcome by excitement and relief. My power, it still didn't seem real, had shown up again and kept me from making a fool of myself. I'd made it through my introduction to the king and my audience with the queen, and I was going to be given a gracious kefta.
Jenya,
the Darkling called after us.
The kefta will be black.
Jenya drew a startled breath. I looked at her stunned face and then at the Darkling, who was already turning to go. Wait, I called before I could stop myself. The Darkling halted and turned those slate-colored eyes on me. If it would be all right, I'd prefer to have blue robes. Summoner's blue.
Alina!
Exclaimed Jenya, clearly horrified. But the Darkling held up a hand to silence her.
Why?
He asked, his expression unreadable. I already feel like I don't belong here. I think it might be easier if I weren't singled out.
Are you so anxious to be like everyone else?
My chin lifted. He clearly didn't approve. But I wasn't going to back down. I just don't want to be more conspicuous than I already am. The Darkling looked at me for a long moment. I wasn't sure if he was thinking over what I'd said or trying to intimidate me, but I gritted my teeth and returned his gaze. Abruptly, he nodded.
As you wish,
he said.
Your kefta will be blue.
And without another word, he turned his back on us and disappeared down the hall. Jenya stared at me, aghast. What? I asked defensively.
Alina?
Jenya said slowly.
No other Grisha has ever been permitted to wear a Darkling's colors.
Do you think he's angry?
That's hardly the point.
It would have been a mark of your standing,
of the Darkling's esteem. It would have placed you high above all others.
Well, I don't want to be high above all others. Jenya threw up her hands in exasperation and took me by the elbow, leading me back through the palace to the main entrance. Two liveried servants opened the large golden doors for us. With a jolt, I realized they were wearing white and gold, the same colors as Jenya's kefta. A servant's colors. No wonder she thought I was crazy for refusing the Darkling's offer. And maybe she was right. The thought stayed through me through the long walk back across the grounds to the little palace. Dusk was falling, and servants were lighting the lamps that lined the gravel path. By the time we climbed the stairs to my room, my stomach was in knots. I sat down by the window, staring out at the grounds. While I brooded, Jenya rang for a servant whom she sent to find a seamstress and order up a dinner tray. But before she sent the girl away, she turned to me.
Maybe you'd prefer to wait and dine with Agrisha later tonight, she asked.
I shook my head. I was far too tired and overwhelmed to even think about being around another crowd of people.
But would you stay?
I asked her. She hesitated.
You don't have to, of course,
I said quickly. I'm sure you'll want to eat with everyone else.
Not at all.
Dinner for two, then, she said imperiously. And the servant raced off. Jenya closed the door and walked to the little dressing table where she started straightening the items on its surface. A comb, a brush, a pen and pot of ink. I didn't recognize any of them, but someone must have had them brought to my room for me. With her back still to me, Jenya said,
Alina, you should understand that when you start your training tomorrow, well, Corporal Kai, don't eat with summoners. Summoners don't dine with fabricators.
And I felt instantly defensive. Look, if you don't want to stay for dinner, I promise not to cry into my soup.
No, she exclaimed. It's not that at all. I'm just trying to explain the way things work.
Forget it. Jenya blew out a frustrated breath.
You don't understand. It's a great honor to be asked to dine with you. But the other Grisha might not approve.
Why?
Jenya sighed and sat down on one of the carved chairs. Because I'm the queen's pet. Because they don't consider what I do valuable. A lot of reasons. I considered what the other reasons might be and if they had something to do with the king. I thought of the liveried servants standing at every doorway in the grand palace, all of them dressed in white and gold. What must it be like for Genya, isolated from her own kind, but not a true member of the court? It's funny, I said after a while. I always thought that being beautiful would make life so much easier. Oh, it does, Genya said, and laughed. I couldn't help but laugh, too. We were interrupted by a knock on the door, and the seamstress soon had us occupied with fittings and measurements. When she had finished and was gathering up her muslin and pins, Genya whispered, "It's not too late, you know. You could still..." But I cut her off. "Blue," I said firmly, though my stomach clenched again. The seamstress left, and we turned our attention to dinner. The food was less alien than I'd expected, the kind of food we'd eaten on feast days at Kerimson. Sweet pea porridge, quail roasted in honey and fresh figs. I found I was hungrier than I'd ever been, and had to resist picking up my plate to lick it. Genya maintained a steady stream of chatter during dinner, mostly about Grisha gossip. I didn't know any of the people she was talking about, but I was grateful not to have to make conversation, so I nodded and smiled when necessary. When the last servants left, taking our dinner dishes with them, I couldn't suppress a yawn, and Genya rose. "I'll come get you for breakfast in the morning. It will take a while for you to learn your way around. The little palace can be a bit of a maze." Then her perfect lips turned up in a mischievous smile. "You should try to rest. Tomorrow you meet Bagra." "Bagra?" Genya grinned wickedly. "Oh, yes, she's an absolute treat." Before I could ask what she meant, she gave me a little wave and slipped out the door. I bit my lip. Exactly what was in store for me tomorrow? As the door closed behind Genya, I felt fatigue creep over me. The thrill of knowing that my power might actually be real, the excitement of meeting the king and queen, the strange marvels of the grand palace and the little palace had kept my exhaustion at bay, but now it returned, and with it a huge echoing feeling of loneliness. I undressed, hung my uniform neatly on a peg behind the star-speckled screen, and placed my shiny new boots beneath it. I rubbed the brush wool of the coat between my fingers, hoping to find some sense of familiarity, but the fabric felt wrong. Too stiff, too new. I suddenly missed my dirty old coat. I changed into a nightdress of soft white cotton and rinsed my face. As I patted it dry, I caught a glimpse of myself in the glass above the basin. Maybe it was the lamplight, but I thought I looked even better than when Genya had first finished her work on me. After a moment, I realized I was just gawking at myself in the mirror and had to smile. For a girl who hated looking at herself, I was at risk of becoming vain. I climbed onto the high bed, slid beneath the heavy silks and furs, and blew out the lamp. Distantly, I heard a door closing, voices calling their goodnights, the sound of the little palace going to sleep. I stared into the darkness. I'd never had a room to myself before. In Kerimsen, I'd slept in an old portrait hall that had been converted into a dormitory, surrounded by countless other girls. In the army, I'd slept in the barracks or tents with the other surveyors. My new room felt huge and empty. In the silence, all the events of the day rushed in on me, and tears pricked my eyes. Maybe I would wake tomorrow and find that it had all been a dream, that Alexei was still alive and Mal was unhurt, that no one had tried to kill me, that I'd never met the king and queen or seen the apparat or felt the darkling's hand on the nape of my neck. Maybe I would wake to smell the campfires burning, safe in my own clothes, on my little cot, and I could tell Mal all about this strange and terrifying but very beautiful dream.
I rubbed my thumb over the scar in my palm and heard Mal's voice saying, "We'll be okay, Alina. We always are." "I hope so, Mal," I whispered into my pillow, and let my tears carry me to sleep. Chapter 8. After a restless night, I woke early and couldn't get back to sleep. I'd forgotten to close the curtains when I went to bed, and sunlight was streaming through the windows. I thought about getting up to close them and trying to go back to sleep, but I just didn't have the energy. I wasn't sure if it was worry and fear that had kept me tossing and turning, or the unfamiliar luxury of sleeping in a real bed after so many months spent on wobbly canvas cots or with nothing but a bedroll between me and the hard ground. I stretched and reached out to run a finger over the intricately carved birds and flowers on the bedpost. High above me, the canopy of the bed opened to reveal a ceiling painted in bold colors, an elaborate pattern of leaves and flowers and birds in flight. As I was staring up at it, counting the leaves of a juniper wreath, and beginning to doze off again, a soft knock came at the door. I threw off the heavy covers and slid my feet into the little fur-lined slippers set out by the bed. When I opened the door, a servant was waiting with a stack of clothing, a pair of boots, and a dark blue kefta draped over her arm. I barely had time to thank her before she bobbed a curtsy and disappeared. I closed the door and set the boots and clothing down on the bed. The new kefta I hung carefully over the dressing screen. For a while I just looked at it. I'd spent my life in clothes passed down from older orphans, and then in the standard-issue uniform of the First Army. I'd certainly never had anything made for me, and I'd never dreamed that I would wear a Grisha kefta. I washed my face and combed my hair. I wasn't sure when Jenya would be arriving, so I didn't know if I had time for a bath. I was desperate for a glass of tea, but I didn't have the courage to ring for a servant. Finally, there was nothing left for me to do. I started with a pile of clothes on the bed, close-fitting breeches of fabric I'd never encountered that seemed to fit and move like a second skin, a long blouse of thin cotton that tied with a dark blue sash, and boots. But to call them boots didn't seem right. I'd owned boots. These were something else entirely, made of the softest black leather and fitted perfectly to my calves. They were strange clothes, similar to what peasant men and farmers wore, but the fabrics were finer and more expensive than any peasant could ever hope to afford. When I was dressed, I eyed the kefta. Was I really going to put that on? Was I really going to be a Grisha? It didn't seem possible. "It's just a coat," I chided myself. I took a deep breath, pulled the kefta off the screen, and slipped it on. It was lighter than it looked, and like the other clothes, it fit perfectly. I fastened the little hidden buttons in the front and stepped back to try to look at myself in the mirror above the basin. The kefta was deepest midnight blue and fell nearly to my feet. The sleeves were wide, and I thought it was a lot like a coat. It was so elegant I felt as if I were wearing a gown. Then I noticed the embroidery at the cuffs. Like all Grisha, the Ethereali indicated their designation within their order by color of embroidery, pale blue for tide makers, red for inferni, and silver for squalors. My cuffs were embroidered in gold. I ran my finger over the gleaming threads, feeling a sharp twinge of anxiety, and nearly jumped when a knock sounded at the door. "Very nice," said Jenya when I opened the door. "But you would have looked better in black." I did the graceful thing and stuck my tongue out at her, then hurried to follow as she swept down the hallway and descended the stairs. Jenya led me to the same domed room where we had gathered the previous afternoon for the processional. It wasn't nearly as crowded today, but there was still a lively buzz of conversation. In the corners, Grisha clustered around samovars and lounged on divans, warming themselves by elaborately tiled ovens. Others breakfasted at the four long tables arranged in a square at the room's center. Again a hush seemed to fall as we entered, but this time people at least pretended to carry on their conversations as we passed.
Two girls in summoner's robes swooped down on us. I recognized Marie from her argument with Sergei before the processional.
Alina, she said, we weren't properly introduced yesterday. I'm Marie, and this is Nadia.
She gestured to the apple-cheeked girl beside her, who smiled toothily.